Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Cinema D'Amore. I am Chuck Phillips, joined by
James Reinhardt
and Justin Morgan.
And we're continuing on with Justin's idea for Hidden Gems. Last week did Cast a Deadly Spell, James's pick, and this week it's mine, and we're talking about a screwball comedy called Hell's a Poppin' from 1941.
Hell's a Poppin'. The title song is very catchy.
I was singing it to myself all day at work today.
I watched it Friday or something, and yeah, the song's definitely been in my head too.
This is one of those movies that I don't know if, other than a couple other movies that, depending on what their title is, that they repeatedly tell you what the title of this film is numerous times, and it's always a great, like, when someone goes, now this is just getting ridiculous, and one of them goes, it's Hell's a Poppin', anything could happen, and they just keep telling you that multiple times. They just want to remind you what you have sat down to watch, because, I don't know, maybe you can get lost, because this is a film about the making of a film, about the making of another film that has a stage show in that film.
I watched it pretty closely, and I don't know if I could ever explain the plot to anybody.
Yeah, it moves very fast, and there's so much happening. And, like, yeah, I don't know if I can explain what's happening. I really enjoyed it, but it's like old 1940s.
A joke, you know, a second, easily.
Yeah. Everyone's very snappy. Like, the dialogue is back and forth, lightning fast. And, like, they're laying it out to you what's happening, like, super fast. But I would say, like, I don't know. I don't even know if the story, like, is important in this movie. I feel like most of it is just a vehicle for this sort of absurdist comedy that they wanted to do.
Yeah, that's definitely – it definitely is one of those films that challenges – the idea that story even matters, which the characters even flat out say in the beginning when they start off in the production of Hell's a Poppin', and they first break the fourth wall by having the director come out and tell them, you know, this movie needs a story. And they're like, I don't think it does. Pretty sure it's going just fine the way it is. We ran this show on Broadway. And he's like, no, you got to change things for Hollywood. And I think it's that plus him telling him about, you know, you have to add the romance in is a very good meta critique of those type of films. You had that with, like, the Marx Brothers films, where a lot of theirs are, the comedy's great, but they always just had, like, a shoehorned romance plot that's easily the worst parts of any of the Marx Brothers movies, because it's not interesting in the slightest. You just want to see the comedians doing the comedy, but the producers are always like, oh, you have to have a love story, or, you know, couples won't go and watch it.
Yeah, I brought that up too when I was watching this, is it felt like a Marx Brothers movie where there's a really boring romance story between two really boring characters, and you're just kind of waiting for, like, the goofy side characters to show up and do their thing.
Yeah, they definitely they even do a really good job of, like, undercutting even the moments that are supposed to be, like, serious romantic moments. Like, the first song between that couple is interrupted numerous times by a title card saying, Stinky Miller, go home.
Oh, yeah. That was one of my favorite parts.
They even just flat out, everyone stops and stares at the camera and goes,
and it's, yeah, like a go child home, or Stinky. Something.
Yeah.
It's like, Stinky Miller, your mom's looking for you.
There's like an actual silhouette, like Mystery Science Theater, of, like, a kid getting up in front of the projector and leaving.
Mm-hmm.
I did like right off the bat that it had Shemp, who is my favorite of the Three Stooges, even though he's not the original, one of the original Three Stooges. Or was he? He's
technically the original, and then he got replaced by Curly.
Yeah.
And then sometimes there was, like, all four of them in some movies.
So I was instantly impressed watching something from 1941. I was like, oh, Shemp.
I didn't think
I was going to recognize anybody.
That's a great moment. Multiple times when they interact with him being the theater projector, projecting their movie, and they keep yelling back and forth at him. That's my cousin Louie. Hey, come on, Louie, get it going. You got to bring it back over here.
It did seem to be more focused towards the filmmaker than the audience. There was like a lot of small little jab. Well, most of the jabs, I think, were at the people making a movie than the people watching a movie.
Yeah, it was. It felt like, I mean, obviously it's very meta, but yeah, it felt like they're making fun of this filmmaking process and films of that time. And like, it's one of those things where I watch this, I'm like, I could kind of see how like this has kind of been forgotten, because it's definitely not like any other movie I've seen in the 40s. But I feel like this is one of those things that modern audiences would really gravitate towards if they ever discovered it.
Especially like the meta, like almost everything, but when the cameraman realizes that he's going to have to work so damn long, and then the cameraman kills himself off camera, which I thought was clever.
Yeah, that's a great moment. How long till we finish the movie? And then just the gunshot. Call for a new cameraman. Yeah, there's a lot of great moments. That opening sequence is, I love it when it just immediately jumps straight into the recording of the production. All sorts of just insanity going on. I also kind of thought, because Justin, you brought up, you texted me that you thought, like, for the time, the special effects were pretty decent and were really interesting. I almost wonder, like, when they tell Shemp to rewind the film, like, to most people, I think you think about it now, like, oh yeah, there's VCRs, we could rewind things, but like, people would even think about like rewinding things back in like 1941 to be like, oh yeah, just reverse the reels and send it back, and it plays out the entire scene.
I mean, they were rewinding other stuff, like that woman that came out of the water and then she was up on the diving board.
Oh yeah,
stuff like that. But yeah, some of the effects, like the one guy that's going back and forth behind the tree and changing his outfit, and like a few times the effects like are kind of shitty, but for the most part, like, you know, like a shoulder will be like floating on one side of the tree when it shouldn't be, or the scene where the one guy just essentially becomes legs and the other guy is just his top half.
Yeah,
and they like, I mean, it's not the best looking, but it's pretty good. Like, it's not terrible.
Yeah, the master of disguise.
Mm-hmm.
That character really reminded me of Gene Parmesan from Arrested Development. I was watching, I'm like, I wonder if
Gene.
Like, yeah, I'm like, I wonder if they took inspiration from this for that character. This like absurd PI that keeps changing disguises, except unlike Gene Parmesan, his disguises seem to be somewhat successful.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that's if they had seen that. This seems to be, I guess, to mention how I discovered this film to bring to you guys. When we talked about Gremlins a few years ago, I just was trying to look up like other information, something that I hadn't heard before, like behind the scenes stuff. And Joe Dante just brought up that this was something that he took a lot of gags from, that he just really enjoyed this film. And you could definitely see it in multiple ways from especially Gremlins 2, with a lot more cartoonish stuff going on in that film, turns into like basically a live action Looney Tunes movie.
Oh my God. Gremlins last week, Gremlins this week. Yeah,
we're always going to, we'll find a way to bring back the next movie to Gremlins.
It's a running theme. Yeah. I thought that I think you mentioned, earlier to us that Joe Dante took a lot of inspiration from this. And I absolutely see it. The whole bit of the projectionists really reminded me of Gremlins 2.
Yeah.
But like you also said, like, it's basically a live action cartoon. And that's how I really felt watching this was.
And that's why Shemp was there.
Yeah, Shemp was there. Yeah.
No, that's why he was there.
Yeah.
They needed his slapstick genius to make the movie work.
But yeah, I mean, and Joe Dante's movies, he combines like, you know, sort of the attitudes of 1950s sci-fi movies of like this sort of Looney Tunes aesthetic. And I definitely feel like this movie really was a big inspiration on him.
I don't think I like the beginning of a movie so fast.
Yeah.
Like, this movie was like instantly like, this is going to be a great movie.
Yeah. As soon as it jumps into a musical number in hell, I was like, I don't fucking know what's going on, but I'm in. You got me.
it seems kind of dicey for the time too. Like some of the numbers where they were singing and stuff, I could imagine my grandparents liking it. But then with all the hell stuff, I'm like, I don't see them liking that though.
Yeah, just immediately starts with Satan and just devils with pitchforks stabbing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like pretty sure women that are like being barbecued or something.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the scene of the devils sharpening their pitchforks. I mean, I have to think that Peter Jackson saw that when he was filming like Isengard with all the orcs and Uruk-hai, you know, sharpening their weapons. I mean, it's like a shot for shot remake.
I like how they were tricked to going to hell and that like the cab ride.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the first time the cab driver's ever driven me somewhere straight when I told him to go. there's a lot of great moments leading it off. That's where we have the instant running joke of Mrs. Jones and that guy with his shrub that starts out like as a little sapling in a little tiny pot that runs throughout the entire film.
Mrs. Jones,
which that's apparently there's some moments when I was looking up this film that I guess that was just an actual thing that they would do in the Broadway version of it, was they would just have random people like planted in the audience to get up and do things and like interact with the audience, or yeah, like literally just having a guy walk around the theater the entire time screaming for somebody.
Hell's a Poppin' was a play.
Yeah, it was a Broadway show first. It was actually, when I looked it up, they said at the time it was like the longest running Broadway show of all time.
Then Cats happened.
Then Cats happened, and they said it's still in like the top 100 like most successful shows on Broadway in history.
It does seem very Mel Brooks-ish. Like, I imagine him loving this.
Yeah, I was reading about the play too. It was known for it was really big on audience participation. Which makes me wonder about the ending of this, where they're putting on a play and like there's absurdity happening on stage, but there's also like all this shit happening in the audience. It made me wonder if you saw this live, if you, all that stuff that's happening on screen in the movie would be happening to you in the audience.
Yeah, the whole thing is done for that one person that got drugged to the play and has no idea what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah, there's a lot of good things. There's another film that has a direct reference that I hope that maybe they got from this is there's another moment where the cameraman, I think they say they talk to Louis the projectionist, but it's like the cameraman stays frozen on like a woman and the characters have to like walk over and be like, hey, you need to get over here, which is a moment that they use in Wayne's World when Ed O'Neill's character shows up on screen. He starts like giving a monologue and like Wayne has to come over and be like, excuse me, this is our film. There's another great like fourth wall breaking thing.
I feel like they must have taken inspiration from this, either knowing or not knowing, because this, I mean, I could be mistaken, but this seems to be the earliest example I've seen of, you know, fourth wall breaking and being really meta about being a movie. And obviously that's very big now. And that was big in, you know, say the 90s, a lot of those fourth wall breaking jokes got really big, but it makes me, I mean, it makes me feel like, you know, if they weren't directly influenced by this, that then they're influenced by films that had been influenced by this.
They're probably familiar with it because I mean, what, it's only 40 years before Wayne's World. And, what, 40 years ago, we're getting like Shining, Raging Bull, and things that are, you know, still pretty strong in our memories. So I'm sure they thought about it and it didn't get forgotten. Hell's a Poppin' really made me laugh when Chuck was like, that was his pick. I was like, it sounds like a Rob Zombie song. not anymore. Not now that I have the actual song stuck in my head. But before, I could imagine like Rob Zombie's new album, Hell's a Poppin', 100%.
Rob Zombie, somewhere he just like woke up and heard that, he's like, oh, it's a brilliant idea.
Hell's, he probably loves Hell's a Poppin'. He's like, no, I know exactly what Hell's a Poppin' is. It's my favorite.
Well, as I discovered, you know, there's an episode of Spawn, the anime series, called Hell's a Poppin'.
Oh, I found that out probably the same way you did.
Looking to see if this movie is on HBO Max.
Like, yeah, trying to find a place to watch the movie. I was like, oh, season 2, episode 6 of Spawn the Animated Series, Hell's a Poppin'. Should have watched it. I wonder if it had any reference whatsoever to this movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always felt like watching Spawn the Animated Series, but I haven't yet.
I mean, there's only like 12 episodes, so you'd get through it pretty quick.
There was more than one season.
I think there was like 3 at the most.
And they did 12 episodes amongst 3 seasons?
I think so. They're pretty short. I have the series, but I've never watched the whole thing.
It's like the Castlevania show on Netflix. It's like every season's like 4 episodes long, but it takes you easily like less than 2 hours to watch a season.
Yeah, I think it was one of those. It probably like, because the animation's really good in it, and it was probably too expensive, or at least like HBO probably felt it was too expensive to make a cartoon to put on their pay cable network. And not enough people were watching it to keep making it.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. I feel like now a Spawn show would probably be good because like geek culture is really big. But that was, you know, in the 90s when there wasn't really much as far as geek culture. And there was the Spawn movie, but that didn't do that well box office wise.
It had John Leguizamo. Excuse me. I like had the, I don't know what the hell happened to me. John Leguizamo's in it.
It did. But, you know. That wasn't enough to save the Spawn movie. But like, no. Like Spawn is weird because like it had this moment in the 90s when Spawn was really popular, but it was only like really in comic circles. And then, you know, the movie didn't really.
It was like a toy line. The toy line was really big.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, everyone loves the toys.
Like there's a really interesting story to be told about how like McFarlane just kind of pushed his own, you know, idea because he wrote Spawn comics and then he started his own toy company and it started making the Spawn toys and how that really helped push Spawn into the, you know, the cultural conversation, so to say.
Yeah. I mean, I think his toy line made toys for like everything. I think I have like 2 figures from Planet Terror. I'm pretty sure they're his. And he did like Lost. Remember Lost? They were like started doing characters from that show. I think that's him too.
Yeah. There's
like, he did a bunch of random stuff.
There's like a, like right at, you know, I'd say, you know, late 90s, you know, Spawn toys got really big and then he started making other properties and kind of, this was at the point when like action figures were going from being stuff for children to like, you know, collectibles for adults. And he was like right at the forefront of that. And then he made, you know, the, but yeah, he made like Movie Maniacs, which were toys based off of modern horror films like Freddy and Jason. Mm-hmm. So it really helped to make these, you know, collector oriented adult toy lines that then went into, you know, stuff like you said, like Planet Terror or like Lost and stuff like that.
Maybe it'll be back because I know he's been like, he wrote some Spawn film that he's hoping to direct himself, which he keeps comparing to Jaws. Mm-hmm. So I just assume you just don't see Spawn like ever.
That's Jaws and Seven. He's compared to Seven a lot.
Perfect. It could be good. I remember the movie being, I liked the movie as a kid, but it's like way over the top and terrible. Violator. Yeah. I remember him. I think I had a toy of him.
Yeah.
And that stupid, well, the reason I brought up John Leguizamo is because I couldn't believe that was him.
Oh, in Spawn?
Yeah, when he's the, I forget the clown's name. I couldn't believe that it was him.
He's just called the clown.
It's just good, yeah.
Oh, there we go.
There's no name to forget when you don't have a name.
He becomes the Violator.
Yeah.
But,
off on that tangent, but, you know.
Yeah, you might have to lead this all very strongly, Chuck, because I don't even know where to jump in the hell of the
pops. Yeah, it's a weird one to go in and out on, just because it moves so fast. My other favorite reference, which, James, I hope you appreciated the Citizen Kane reference in this film.
Yeah, I laughed really hard at that one.
Just that random. I thought they burned that.
Mm-hmm. That the random cameo from the Frankenstein monster at the end.
I it had been a while since I had seen this film. And I kind of forgot. I forgot that those two things were in there. Like, that was my first thought when I saw both of them. It's like, oh, James will probably be pleasantly surprised at both of those things that randomly happen.
Yeah.
For no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, the Frankenstein monster just shows up in the audience randomly. Apparently, that is a stuntman plays the monster, and it's the same makeup as Karloff. That is actually the second actor to play the monster after Boris Karloff.
Yeah, they were allowed, since it was a Universal film, they had the rights to use it, so they were getting their money's worth. It's probably one of those, like, they just have it lying around, and it's like anybody could just walk up and be like, hey, can we have Frankenstein in our movie? And they're like, well, sure.
They walked around the Universal storage lockers, and they're like, we can use anything, right, since it's Universal.
Yeah.
It's much like the basis of their play when they show up to the house with their cartload of things borrowed from the museum. They just walk in and take whatever they need. It's not stealing if we take it back, right? Yeah. That's another great moment I love, when they keep breaking things, and he just goes, hey, where's that scene? And he just keeps ripping the pages out of the story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I love that.
Didn't know it was a play beforehand or musical beforehand, so I thought a lot of the songs were catchy. A lot of the dancing and stuff, I was like, damn, that's actually pretty damn good. I don't usually am not gravitated towards musicals in any sort of way. But no, I dug this. It reminded me, like, it felt like it was constantly making fun of musicals as it was a musical.
Yeah. This really felt like an early parody of, you know, the popular comedy / musicals of the time. It really felt like it was poking fun at those. And I should add, I guess, because it is kind of hard to describe what's going on in this movie. It's really best, seen and experienced. It is on YouTube. So if any of you want to watch it after you're done listening to our conversation, I would definitely say look it up on YouTube, because it's worth a look. And it's only like an hour 20. But I definitely highly recommend.
I wanted to start like something else right after. I almost started to watch it.
It
was like college party or something. And it was like looked like everybody was 40 years old at the college party. And I was like, maybe another time.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. It's on YouTube, and I think I saw a couple there. They did 4 movies for Universal. This was their first one, and I think a couple of the other ones all look like they were on YouTube as well. This movie doesn't. I guess it's a weird rights issue with whoever technically owns the copyright to the stage play, is at least how I read it somewhere, and that's why it's not. Not on like home video anywhere.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I got it on people started making it was being released in Europe, and then that's how I got my DVD. I got it for like $5 after I read the information from like Joe Dante. I was like, I looked it up. It was on Amazon for $5, and it's one of those like unmarked DVDs. Well, it's marked, but definitely you can tell it's like one that somebody just made somewhere. It's not an officially authorized.
When you said unmarked, I was like, I have no idea what you mean.
Yeah, I guess I just meant like it's not a professional DVD sale. It's definitely like just made in somebody's garage or something like that. Apparently just taken from the European version that's been released, but you can't get it.
I remember one of my mom's boyfriends bought Song of the South on VHS from like the personal ads, and then it was literally just a VHS tape like recording of Song of the South, and he paid like $30 for it. I'm like, you just paid $30 for a tape that someone's just mass producing.
Yeah, it's like last year for Christmas, my brother got me Michael Mann's To Keep on DVD. Mm-hmm. And it's like clearly because To Keep was never released on DVD. Michael Mann's disowned it. But I watched it, and it is clearly someone just had this on VHS and just transferred it to a DVD. So you're just watching a VHS quality on DVD, and complete of like the tracking at the bottom and stuff. it was so charming. I love it.
Don't discuss all your illegal activities. I got like the Star Wars trilogy on Blu-ray, like the original cut. And it was like, do not buy if you don't already own it. And I'm like, well, I have it on DVD, so I'm going to count that.
That's like the way when you're talking about like you probably have the same DVDs that I might have that feature the original edits as bonus features, and they're like Laserdisc quality, like they're so grainy and such low quality. But I guess if you're that desperate to watch the original versions on an actual disc. That's like your only option.
Mine's those despecialized versions, so.
I know which type you're talking about, but I'm talking about your DVDs.
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, no, mine are actually the very first release of the DVDs from maybe like 2004, and they didn't have that. The standalone ones that came out like the year after or like 2 years after, they threw on like the original theatrical version as a bonus and look like shit. Yeah,
that's how mine are.
Mine don't even have those.
Yeah, I have that DVD release that has the original undoctored versions as a bonus feature. And yeah, the quality is what
that's
it
why
is.
I had to go with despecialized. I'm like, it's perfect. This is as close as we're gonna get.
You know, there's someone out there that watches those like crappy quality, like Laserdisc VHS level, and it's just like somebody's like, "Why do you do it?" And he's like, "I won't bring myself to watch a special edition. This is my only version."
You're kind of describing me. That's the only version I watch. I don't know why.
Yeah, same
maybe
here.
I'll dive in after a couple years and I'll watch the special edition from 2020 or something. Because every time they do a new edition, they add more shit to it. There is literally like 100 versions of each film.
Yeah, it's getting a little out of hand.
But anyways, I would like to thank you, Chuck, for picking another movie that was almost virtually nowhere. At least it was on YouTube.
Yeah, it's some. I don't know how I managed to. Like, I'm not purposely trying to be the most obscure person possible, but I somehow keep doing
it. Difficult ones.
Yeah. This one was at least
on. Girl Who Knew Too Much, Possession, and then this.
Yeah, this one was at least on YouTube. You had like a slight advantage there. Those other ones were like just nowhere to be found. I mean, when James has to buy the Blu-ray just to be able to watch one of them.
YouTube usually throws me off too, because sometimes it's like, oh, it's on YouTube, and it's like for $3. I'm like, it's got to be on streaming somewhere. Well, what? I only have like Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, HBO Max, Apple TV.
And our,
like, come on,
Our favorite streaming service was letting us down. I mean, Hell's a Poppin' wasn't even on effedupmovies.com.
Damn it! Sorry, guys.
They're really bringing us down.
Sorry, guys. We can't reference you this episode.
Yeah, they're going to be losing people.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna lose those hard-fought subscribers.
I don't know what it is. I laughed. I like the whole concept of effedupmovies.com.
So yeah, it's just a funny name to say. Even you don't have to know anything else about it. It's just a funny name.
I'd put up movies that like didn't seem that effed up. Like, oh, here's a Wizard of Oz. Hope I don't get sued. Like, what's effed up about this movie? I'm like, if you pay attention, there's a lot of effed up stuff.
You're like the midgets. That's what really does it.
Well, you know, it'd be kind of cool if you had a site like that and it had like a pop-up video thing where it's like, this is effed up. and this was really effed up. And behind the scenes, this was really effed up. That's what I want.
Yeah. Bringing it back to Hell's a Poppin' there.
Again, never left.
We haven't talked about anything else other than that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Hell's a Poppin'. Do you think you think it would be legal if I just added the song now?
I mean, I would say the thing is probably somewhat in public domain. Like, it probably would not get flagged by anything. I mean, it's on YouTube for free. I kind of consider it once it's on YouTube for free, it's fair game for anybody.
All right, well, give me just a moment and I'll play Hell's a Poppin'.
And it probably will. Hell's a poppin', and there's a rumor now you'll be needin' your sense of humor now. How it will wind up, no one can tell. But hell's a poppin', Mike. screaming at the car. Anything can happen, and it probably will. Hell's a poppin'. Dun, 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 oh, dun, dun, dun. Your sense of humor now, how it will wind up. No one can tell, but hell's a poppin' like.
Calling all devils, calling all devils, stop being so wasteful. We have lost our priorities on fire and brimstone, that is all.
Okay, boys, get him up. Let him to the warehouse with more funds. A running low. Turn on some more heat.
Right.
Stand back, everybody. Stand back. Here come our prize guests.
Yeah, that's probably good.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed it. That's Hell's a Poppin'. Hopefully you enjoyed that.
This should be our intro and outro music.
I don't want to get shut down right in the beginning. That's a nice surprise in the middle of the episode.
That's a, yeah, that'll be, that's, I mean, that's a good tagline for our podcast, you know. It's Hell's a Poppin'. Anything could happen.
Yeah.
We just start playing old stuff from our other episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, just throwing in random, you just start cutting old clips of, taking like James out of context entirely, just throwing some random.
I mix it so James is talking to James perfectly.
I mean, if you want to summarize to our listeners what the Hell's a Poppin' viewing experience is like, that's the way to do it.
That's actually, I mean, I honestly feel like we shouldn't have been thinking about this during the episode, and we should have released the whole episode as just insane. And people are like, I don't understand what that is. And they never discuss the movie once.
Yeah. Never go into any details. Just throw some random stuff all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where we're dilly-dallying all over the place. But that really is this movie. It is kind of like having ADD or something. Like, you know, there's like the scene where they're discussing the movie and they're moving from set to set. And every set they move on to, they have different costumes, something else is happening. And then they're discussing the plot of their new movie of the screenwriter played by that guy who I've seen in everything, whose name,
Alicia Cook Jr.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah. I'm like, oh, hey, that guy.
That's all pale and, gaunt looking.
Mm-hmm.
His moment when he, screams at them still scares me every time. Cause I always forget that that's like the punchline of what was that? He just screams his name at him.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, then they dive into like this classic romantic story. It's like a love square. And then you have the main characters are still there as like these comic relief characters. But they're easily, obviously you care more about watching them than the actual people involved in the love story.
I like, why are we looking at this guy? Go back to the girl.
Yeah.
We have the girl right there. Why do we want to watch this guy?
Yeah. It's a picture. Let me show you the picture. Then they all just sit down in front of the picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great.
Take your picture, and then the guy takes the picture off the wall.
Yeah, it's a lot of great moments like that. Yeah, then they jump in. It's a classic story of they have to put on a stage show, which they even at first go, oh, it's got a stage show in it. No, for their buddy Jeff to impress his impress the critics, impress the show producers to make the girl fall in love with him. Again, the movie doesn't care, like kind of like James said, the movie does not care all that much about the romance. It's definitely just put in there to be a thing like that's expected out of a film like this, that you have to have that romance plot in it. But yeah, that just immediately starts. They use they have a lot of great prop comedy to start off that segment of like the guy with the balloons going up and down, and he gets the bag, then the balloons send him up, and he blows him away with the shotgun. Yeah. What's the balloon scene? This page. Okay, that's gone.
Yeah.
Then it goes in. Another thing I kind of looked up, and I didn't know if this film influence somewhat. We get the character of Pepe, who is the, as they describe him, the phony, which so everyone thinks he's making it up that he's some sort of European aristocrat, but they all think it's funny, so they just let him like basically mooch off of them, and he just lives in their houses and gets things for free because they all just think he's funny, which then is a great moment when another seemingly foreign dignitary recognizes him, and he's like, "Ah, you can't reveal to them that I'm actually a foreign dignitary. Then they won't think I'm a phony, and then I won't get free things anymore."
Yeah, I really like the character of Pepe, but I think I know where you're going with it, so I'll let you.
Are you also thinking that perhaps this is where they got Pepe Le Pew from?
Yeah, I was wondering about that because, like, the scene where he falls in love with that woman and he's pulling doing a full Pepe Le Pew where he's, you know, two steps away from sexually assaulting her. but yeah, I was like, I thought that too. I'm like, is this where they came up with the idea for Pepe Le Pew?
I did look it up. It is. Pepe Le Pew was first created 4 years after this movie in 1945. So, I mean, this did come out first.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I couldn't find anything about that either, but I was just wondering, I'm like, I really wonder if that's where, that came from.
I would say yes, from your research.
It feels like it. It feels like somebody somewhere saw this, and apparently thought that, yeah, like James said, like basically full on like sexually harassing a woman is great for comedy. And is like, we can make a whole character out of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great running plot line is the one girl that they refer to as the kid sister that they bring along with them is madly in love with him. And I love the great moment. Which one's the woman? The woman with like all these diamonds steps in front of her. He's like, I don't want to point, but it's the lady loaded down with the ice. And he's like, ah, right. And then the woman walks away and she's literally just standing there with a giant block of ice. He's like, ah, loaded down with the ice. I see. Also sees her face and just goes, well, what I do for money.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, there's a great moments between them of him. It is very much like a, like 100% every scene with them is like Pepe Le Pew of like, he's supposed to be like this romantic, but then it gets turned on him like real quick once he doesn't want to be involved with her and like is constantly trying to escape her. He keeps getting hit with random various objects that keep driving him more and more to her.
Mm-hmm.
He gets that great moment. I don't know why. I just love the scene where he's in the room with our two main characters, Chick and Oli, and they're all wearing like these satin suits and they're just slowly like ripping the sleeves off of them. They just keep going back and forth until finally they're like getting ready to rip the pants off. They turn around and he's already got the pants off. And he's like, ah.
The fact that one of the characters' name is Chick is like such a 1940s name. I'm like, yeah, the fact that they have a grown man named Chick. But then also maybe think of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Where Abbott's character's name is Chick as well.
There's a Chick in Riverdale.
I've only watched a few episodes of Riverdale.
It's terrible, but I think you should dedicate a lot more time to watching it.
You should do a Riverdale podcast, review every episode.
I could.
Yeah, that's. I like going back to watching these old films like this. I also watched a bunch of Marx Brothers films this week. Leading up to this, to just kind of get in that time frame. And it is interesting the way comedy has changed so much since then. Because if you look at, this, Abbott and Costello, the Marx Brothers movies, the Three Stooges, all of them are essentially not the same. They all have their own kind of unique styles of comedy. But most people were going just to see the two comedians and then be their personas. They weren't going to see, it's not like today where the story, I guess, is more what people want to go see. You don't necessarily pay to see, someone like, I guess, like Danny McBride. He can sometimes play similar characters, or someone even like Will Ferrell. You're not specifically going.
Nowadays, it would be Kevin Hart and The Rock.
Yeah, I guess. I was trying to think of who would be like your top person.
Who do the kids like these days?
But like that's the common criticism amongst a lot of like more modern day comedy films is that's what everyone says, like, oh, Will Ferrell's just always playing the same man baby, or like Adam Sandler in most of his movies. Oh, he's just playing the same character.
Then you see something where they don't do it and they're good, and everyone's like, oh, I hate it. I just wanted regular Will Ferrell.
Yeah, so it's a weird thing. It's like I feel like everyone does still want the same thing, just like in these old films of you just went to see like Groucho Marx be Groucho Marx. He always played the same character with just a different name. And that, like you said, like people see a lot of these new movies and like anytime they try to do something serious, like, you know, Adam Sandler doing something like Funny People, where he's not specifically playing, he's actually making fun of himself for playing that kind of like man baby character. And people are like, oh, that was dumb. I wanted him to make like poopy jokes.
But there's also an interesting conversation to be had in there as to whether or not the like the era of the movie star is dead. Because, yeah, like you brought up in these old movies like this or the Marx Brother movies or Abbott and Costello, you know, your audiences are going to see these comedians who are playing characters with different names, but they're essentially just playing their personas, as you said. Whereas, and, you know, like these comedians' names or even old-time movie stars, like their names would get audiences asses in seats. And like there's a really interesting argument to be said about now as to whether or not, you know, any movie star or comedian really has that power to get someone into seeing a movie, you know, on their name alone. Typically these days it seems more or less people are going for characters or they're going for a story or something like that. They're not really going to see a Will Ferrell movie because they like Will Ferrell. Or, you know, an Adam Sandler movie because they like Adam Sandler.
Yeah, that's an interesting. Yeah, there's very few, like, I don't know, you even like 10, 15 years ago, like one of the last, like, I don't want to say like the last big movie star, but someone like Will Smith, like he was considered, you know, everything he did was a hit. Like he couldn't do bad movies. He was one of those actors that you didn't need to know what it was. It's just like, oh, there's a new Will Smith movie coming out. And then somewhere along the way, he kind of lost that magic. I guess maybe The Rock, like Justin said, maybe the closest thing to, like, people pretty much see his name and they're like, oh, I'm going to see that. It's got The Rock in it.
I read a really interesting article that posited that Leo DiCaprio is the only actor that has that power these days.
Tom Cruise.
I don't know about. I mean,
I don't even know if Tom Cruise outside Mission Impossible, he doesn't even seem to
have that big of a draw. When all he does is Mission Impossible, it's. I mean, I guess that's hard to argue, Chuck.
He got out. He did. I would kind of argue like the thing that would argue against it is something like Live, Die, Repeat, which I thought was a great movie, but like nobody really went to see it. Yeah, Edge of Tomorrow. Yeah. Whichever title you want to use there.
This article I read on Leonardo DiCaprio brought up how, you know, starting with Inception in 2010, he's had a pretty good run of successful movies, and none of them have really been franchises or sequels or reboots. He's actually never done a sequel. But movies that you wouldn't think would be, you know, 100 million plus grossers are that, starring him, and they probably, I mean, obviously Inception is a big one, but, you know, Wolf of Wall Street or like The Revenant or even just last summer, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. A bunch of other movies he's made that have all been like critical successes and huge, you know, grossers, and they're all, you know, these sort of adult oriented character dramas. And they kind of brought up that like Leo's really the only movie star these days that seems to be able to get audiences into seats, you know, based on his involvement with a movie alone, which I thought was a very interesting article, argument to be made that he's the only one that can do that.
Well, you know, I think what happened is how you said he doesn't do sequels. When his first movie's a sequel, and it, maybe he said, I'll never do that again. Even when he's like 13 years old being in Critters 3, and he's like, nope, I'll never do that again.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe he's like, yeah, I've played the franchise game, and I'm done.
I tried to get that sweet Critters money, and it didn't work out for me, so I'm going to be an artistic person.
He's probably makes so much off royalties.
Just from Critters 3.
He's probably like Johnny Depp. He's probably like, if I would have known, I would have came back for it. When they did, what was it, Freddy's Dead?
Oh, yeah.
they never even asked Johnny Depp to reprise his role or like show up again in it. He's like, I definitely would have done it if they would have asked. They thought he was too big.
Yeah.
You're never too big. But yeah, that's an interesting, it's interesting. I guess just to wrap it all back to Hell's a Poppin'. Yeah, just that particular era of films I really enjoy. Just going back to, I don't even know how to describe it. Just that weird sense of humor. It's a lot of odd wordplay, a lot of odd, just out of nowhere. I think one of my favorite things to get all the way to the end when they're doing their big final performance, like the goofiest, dumbest thing in the film that reminds me a lot of, I actually think of, if I was to think of someone that may have pulled something from it, is SpongeBob kind of does this frequently, where they'll have like a guy in an actual like gorilla suit or something as just like a live action element thrown in for like no reason or something like that. And this reminded me of that with the guy in the bear suit when he's in the tree, that guy that's like Mrs. Jones and he's got like a full grown tree. The guy tries to shoot the bear and the bear just looks at him and goes, haha, you missed me. I'm like, what are they doing? Like, that's the most goofy, random thing. Once they hit talking bears, I was like, nope, now it's too ridiculous.
Oh yeah, there's talking bears, there's talking dogs at the end. Like half of their bodies are rendered invisible by the PI guy, because he's apparently a magician too, because of course he is. Everything just goes balls to wall absurd at the end, and you kind of buy it given, you know, this movie sets up, you know, like I said, this Hell's a Poppin', anything could happen. They really set up early on that this film really abides by no rules at all. And, you know,
which is how our podcast should be.
Yeah. No rules at all.
But, yeah. There's another, the other great moment that I would say is always my highlight is when the woman that's in the booth with Shemp knocks the film out of frame. And it's like a great moment of just everything about that scene, the way that I'm assuming they had to like film it with everyone, like the pre-planning that would have had to go into it to film it that way and to have like everyone looking in the wrong directions as if the film was truly broken.
Well, they probably had storyboards.
I would assume. I would
because
hope.
Because you could tell in the same frame that they're like looking, like the one guy is looking up while the other ones are looking down. Their eye line's right, though. Whenever the camera was like swaying and they're like talking about getting nauseous, I was like, I think I might get nauseous if it keeps doing this.
Yeah, then they get transported from the wrong reel.
Yeah.
To the savage Indians. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was laughing really hard at that part where they end up in this Western movie. And they even call out the fake Indians. They're like, can you get us away from these phony Hollywood Indians? I was like, oh, yeah, they even knew back then.
Yeah, that was the first movie to call out Hollywood's injustice towards Native Americans.
That was the first one. Hell's a Poppin'.
Hell's a Poppin'. This random movie.
What a great change in Hollywood history.
Yeah, I don't know much about the play, but I feel like they probably had a lot of fun playing with the stage format. And then when they're told they could make a movie, they're just like, fuck, we could just do whatever we want with the film format now. Because it really just feels like they're kids in a candy store. And we're just doing whatever they could.
They could literally think of anything after it was filmed and probably put it in the movie without ruining the movie at all.
Yeah.
That's one of the things to go back to like Gremlins 2, like that idea. Please. That idea. I'll never stop talking about Gremlins 2, about like using your format to its advantages in different ways. Is one of my favorite stories of how they did with Gremlins 2, like the DVD, the version that's in the DVD that was in the movie theaters. That's when they did the book version. They all have that different moment when the, you know, in the film when the projector stops and Hulk Hogan stands up, and in the book it's like a completely different thing. Like the gremlins took over like the printing press and destroyed like pages out of the book.
And I didn't even know there was a book.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a novelization.
That's a thing, like how they had enough forethought ahead of time to change that one key moment for like the different various ways that you would encounter this film, not just in a movie theater, of like, what if you had the book version? So I think it's an interesting idea to kind of make things more interesting, is don't just, you know, you could just make a movie and then it's like, oh, okay, well, just make a novelization of it. But what about the elements that only make sense in a movie? I guess we can change those. Or like adapting things from a stage play, like that don't make sense to do in a film studio or film set, you know, just change them to something else that would make sense.
So yeah, you mentioned that there's a rights issue with the original play. Do you think maybe that's part of the reason why this film isn't really as well known? Because, you know, in reading about it, it sounds like the play was very popular and well received, and it seems like the film was as well. Do you think maybe that legal battle is what kind of kept this from being, you know, something that is talked about more as far as screwball comedies go?
I think so. Like, because I can't think of any other reason why it wouldn't get mentioned more often. It was in the exact same era and pretty much like the exact same studio. I know it may have potentially, I guess, been overshadowed by Abbott and Costello, which clearly, I mean, just by the basis of the way their projects went, I think got probably more attention from the studio executives. I mean, they had their full on, you know, run of films with the actual, you know, Universal Monsters, as opposed to just like one small cameo. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's just it, a little bit of like being overshadowed by having another comedy duo at the exact same time. Maybe it wasn't enough to differentiate themselves. Whereas like, you know, you have three or four Marx Brothers, three or four Stooges, Abbott and Costello, and they just seem like a smaller group. It was hard to even if you Google Hell's a Poppin', I couldn't really find too much information on it from a lot of sources. So other than there was one site that had the link to the YouTube video and was pretty much like, hey, like, watch this movie. I think it's a pretty good movie that no one's ever heard of. So like somebody else out there has the same thought that I do, apparently. Mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, you should go watch this one random movie that no one else has ever heard of.
That's why we did Hidden Gems.
Yeah.
We needed this movie.
I could see, like, I do see, you know, studios. I do see, like, a studio exec in the 40s watching this movie and being like, the fuck is this? As opposed to, like, you know, Abbott and Costello or the Marx Brothers, you know, where those are much more palatable to audience. Like, the Marx Brothers, there are moments where they break the fourth wall, but they're, like, little moments, you know, like they'll look at the camera or, like, make a joke to the audience or whatever. But, you know, as opposed to this, which is really experimental and really meta, in a period where, like, you know, films weren't really, at least American films weren't really being experimental. They're very controlled by a studio system, so they were, you know, like, you know, that's the whole point of what this film's making fun of, is, you know, they're straightforward romances with, you know, kooky characters, and that was really about it. So I do see, like, maybe part of the reason why is, like, this, I do think this film is really ahead of its time, and maybe it wasn't as palatable to a studio or to audiences at the time.
Who knows? I mean, like I said, I could see my grandparents not liking this movie. I don't really think of, they weren't very conservative and held back, but just like the things that they were offended by, I was like, I don't know. I don't really like see them enjoying this musical that starts in hell. Even though it's like a very funny version of hell, but I could see them being like, I don't know. I don't think hell's very funny.
Yeah. That could be another, like a moral issue sort of thing of, you know, even just people hearing that name being like, oh, it's got devils in it. Oh, I can't be associated with something
hell's
like
that. Hell's not popping.
Yeah.
You think going to hell is funny?
That's like a movie, you know, if kids were to ask their parents, hey, can I have a nickel to go to the movie theater? What are you going to see? Mm. Like that movie. It's a new movie coming out. Yeah. Like, like that movie that you don't want to say the title to your parents, 'cause you're like nervous. And then as soon as you say it, they'll be like, you're going to see what?
Yeah. I'm gonna go see that new musical.
Yeah. It's just a fun family musical. There's even a romance in it. I saw them talk about it. Yeah, it's definitely, I guess I feel like, you know, we're getting towards the end there, towards the final thoughts there. I do think that's partially it, is maybe it was just too ahead of its time, like that people just didn't one of those things that just people couldn't get at the time. And I feel like they are. Yeah. I mean, that's true. I would say that for Cast a Deadly Spell as well. I would say that movie was kind of ahead of its time for like the kind of genre mashup that it was doing. So I'd say for both of our films that we've had so far, that I think is their primary problem of why they never caught on. But I think it's great. And for, hey, it's on YouTube. So, you know, anyone can go back and check this out. And I don't think to compare this a little bit to some of these other movies that I've been watching lately, like Mark's ones, I feel like this one might be the least dated, and maybe it's just because the gags are so random and just kind of come out of nowhere that it doesn't feel like they make a ton of like current event references or to specific people or things that were going on in the 30s and 40s. So I feel like you can get entertainment out of it anytime.
There was like some classical music references, but beyond that, like it won't hold you back.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess my final thoughts would be is, you know, like, I feel like if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably really confused as to what this movie is about, which you're not alone, but I would say watch it for sure. It's tons of fun. It, you know, it really isn't concerned with stuff like plot or story. It's really just, you know, it felt like the filmmakers were just wanted to have fun, and it felt like everyone was really having fun making this movie. It's definitely like not like any of the other screwball comedies I've seen coming from that time period. And it's free on YouTube, so watch it.
In case you guys didn't know, it is free on YouTube. I love this movie. I just honestly do not know how to put into words what I just watched. That's the truth. It's fun. It's a slapstick comedy, and it's really hard to explain. But Chuck, I think, nailed it by saying that it's not. There's nothing in it that's dated enough that you wouldn't enjoy it. It seems pretty, I don't know, modern in a way. Like, the jokes seem more adult or less censored than I was expecting them to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's fun, and it's on YouTube, and the quality is great.
Yeah. Yeah, just pretty good quality.
Yeah, I think if there's anything we've established so far, it's that this movie would have been a much bigger success had it been available free on YouTube in 1941.
If streaming was around in 1941, I think this movie would have caught on.
Yeah.
They had to, like, the years of it being on Napster and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
LimeWire. That's the only way you could watch Hell's a Pop, and it's on LimeWire.
Yeah, this movie. Yeah, I think this movie does for me, like, one of the best things I can get from a comedy is it just puts a smile on my face the entire time I'm watching it. And I feel like if you were to watch this movie and you weren't just kind of smiling and chuckling at every little tiny thing, you might not have a soul. You might not know what comedy is.
Mm-hmm.
The soul test.
Yeah.
You sit somebody down, they have to watch Hell's a Poppin', and depending on how if they didn't smile, you know they're a sociopath.
Yeah, that's the new psychopath test.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I'd be very afraid to take that test. I took one test like that before at Scare House, and I was like, I'm failing this. I'm a sociopath. I was like, I'm probably not disturbed by the stuff I'm supposed to be disturbed by. And they never gave me my results. But that's a different story.
That's because they were too scared by what they saw in your test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was interested. I'm like, I want to know what they found about me. And they're like, oh, we'll definitely email you. They didn't.
they forwarded your results to like the local police, like keep an eye on this guy.
There's a lesson in at the University of Pittsburgh where they just study me, and I don't know about it.
Inside the mind of a serial killer.
Yeah, it's like Minority Report. They're like, will this guy be a serial killer? We've been tracking him for years. Is it a moral obligation of us to say something to the police? Well, he hasn't committed a crime yet, so we don't know. But yeah, good pick.
Yeah, good pick for sure.
Yeah, I think so far, knowing what Justin's pick is, I don't want to spoil it because I know you're going to save it. Okay, but I would say all these picks have been good. James's was the only one I hadn't seen previously. I think these are all good. They're all good hidden gems.
Mine is a wonderful Western called Kioma, and it was pretty much a perfect movie at first sight. There's currently a sale on Barnes & Noble for Arrow movies, so if you want to pick it up cheaper than it normally is, now's the time to do it. So I guess that's partially why I'm bringing it up a little bit early. There's also like a $5 Blu-ray you can find on Amazon that has the Grand Goal with it, so it's really a $2.50 movie.
Yeah.
I'm just
gonna throw out there, Justin, just in case I forget it by the time the next episode, to remind everybody, I've bought this film 3 separate times, and I don't regret that decision.
I was just waiting for the sale again because I'm like, I want all these interviews, and I want the better quality. I don't know why I want the better quality. The movie makes me laugh. It doesn't like need it. It definitely doesn't need it. But yeah, that's what we'll be doing next week, and I feel like that's the best heads up I can give you. I would want to give somebody a heads up if they can get it cheaper. I don't know how people watch this though, or if maybe this month they just give up. They're like, I'm not watching any of these movies, so I'm not listening to these episodes. They went too obscure.
Maybe.
Hey, we're Son Amore, and this is the type of show. These are the type of shows that we produce, and we hope that you enjoy them. I'm on Twitter at JJMorgan19. James.
I'm at James Reinhardt.
Chuck.
ChuckFinn66.
We're at Cinema Demore on Twitter / Cinema Demore on Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, everything. Please subscribe, rate, review us, and above all else, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thanks.